This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello and welcome to The Twilight Show. Thanks for joining me. Today, my special guest is Susan Hilliard, a teacher trainer, consultant based in Argentina. And our topic for today is teaching and learning through drama.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Twilight Show, everyone. I'm Graham Stanley, speaking to you live from Mexico City. As I mentioned earlier on today's show, I'll be talking to Susan Hilliard about teaching and learning through drama. Susan Hilliard has a Bachelor's in Education Honours from Warwick University in the UK and has work experience in 17 countries as a teacher, head of department, director, speaker, webinar presenter, workshop facilitator, consultant, researcher, professor, and online tutor. She is author of a number of books for teachers, including English Through Drama, published by Helbing, and she has been involved with two theatre and education troupes based in Buenos Aires, Argentina, as diction teacher and as an advisor. She's a former coordinator of English in Action, teaching English Through Drama in special education for the Ministry of Education of the City of Buenos Aires in Argentina. And Susan is also the founder and tutor of Shelter, a global online academy for English language teachers. I'll be talking to Susan about her work and more after the Teachers Talk Radio news.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news, is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones? World Book Day on March the 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar, where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests that pupils can come in their pajamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC, and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Burgelsing, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Burgelsing on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time, every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey by Teacher Tap asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC, where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news with John Gibbs.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, and welcome particularly to my special guest, Susan Hilliard. Susan, thank you so much for joining me. And what have you been up to today?
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, actually, and thank you for inviting me. I've been up to a lot of things related to learning curves today. One is designing my webinar. No, it's not a webinar, designing my conference to be held in April on the life and work of Sir Ken Robinson. The problem being that I have to do it in my Spanish. So it's really a big learning curve.
Yeah, it's quite difficult when you have to present in Spanish, isn't it? As you saw when I presented last week, the last time we met, I had to present three times in Spanish 2 days in succession, and it's quite a challenge, isn't it?
It's stressful.
Stressful, yeah. Yeah. So, Sir Ken Robinson was someone you actually knew. Is that, that's right, isn't it? I seem to remember.
Yes, indeed. He was my boyfriend in Liverpool in 1969, before we both went to university. He was awarded a place in Brent College near Leeds, and I was awarded a place in Warwick University in the middle of England. And so we parted company, and we never got in touch with each other again, because there was no internet, there was no email, et cetera, et cetera. And anyway, we were both going to new adventurous lives. And it wasn't until 2012 when I saw him on an unusual video that I hadn't seen before. It was on Vimeo, actually, not on TED. And he talked about his early life. And I suddenly said, oh, no, that's my Ken Robinson. And my husband said to me, get in touch with him then. And I said, no, I can't. I'm just a minion. And another friend of mine, Vicky Saumel, who you probably know, said, send him a tweet. And I said, no, I don't dare. And she said, go on, send him a tweet. So I did. And he answered me immediately.
Oh, wow. And so did you get a chance to see him again, or was that just online correspondence you had?
I never saw him in person again, but he did agree to come to my last Zoom session on my course with a lot of people, because I invited everybody. And he told us all about his future plans, what he was going to do. And then, of course, he wrote to me afterwards and said, can I come back another time? Because I really enjoyed it. And you've got such an amazing group of people there in Argentina. They weren't all from Argentina, actually. And I said, oh, yeah, we would be thrilled. And then, of course, he passed away 6 months later. So his last public appearance was on my Zoom class.
Wow. And so what is it that you're actually preparing related to him then, this presentation in Spanish?
Yeah, I've been invited to the homage, the first homage to Sir Ken Robinson in Latin America by SEMAR, which is a foundation here, which deals with education, particularly neuroscience subjects. And they are doing a homage with five speakers, and I have been invited to be one of them. And when I said yes, I thought it was going to be in English, and then I discovered it was in Spanish. So it's quite a challenge.
Yeah, it's. I'm sure you'll be fine, though. I mean, you've been in Argentina for many years now, haven't you?
Yes, 30 years.
So I'd love to learn a little bit more about how you ended up there. And so maybe you could take us back to what happened after you and Sir Ken Robinson split up.
Yes, that's a long story. Are you ready for it?
ready. Please tell.
I did the four-year B.Ed and passed with honours, I'm very happy to say, in dramatic arts and the sociology of education as a specialism. Right. And after that, I really went to Warwick University because I wanted to be a teacher of Down syndrome children. But I hadn't read the small print, as you know, we don't. And I had to go out into a regular school and teach for 2 years before going back to do the M.Ed in special needs education. So I decided I would do that. And I got a job in a very big comprehensive school in Coventry, which is very close to Warwick, as you know. And I asked if I could teach in the remedial department, as it was called in those days. It's not called that anymore. It's the specific needs department now. And I thought that would be a good lead in to teaching Down syndrome students who obviously have very specific needs. But I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. I had 18 remedial students, all with different specific needs, in the same classroom, and I was teaching them five different subjects per week. So wow. It was a very hard job for a newbie straight out of university.
I can imagine, yeah.
So I cried a lot, but there was nobody to help me. You know, in those days, we didn't have professional development courses, and we didn't have mentors. We just had to get on with it. And so I decided that I had to solve it myself. So I went back to everything I'd learned at university and I reread everything and I reflected on which subject was going best with these 18 remedial students. They were from seven countries and they had 11 different languages between them. And most of them had failed at school. So it was really problematic, especially for a newbie. And I decided that the only subject where I was possibly, and I say that emphatically, reaching them was drama. So I decided to teach geography through drama, maths through drama, English language through drama, English literature through drama, and that was the way I reached them. So I saw that drama had huge potential. If it could work with that kind of student, it could work with anybody, surely. That was what was going on in my head at the time. And so I put together second language acquisition with drama theory. And I came out with this new pedagogy, if you like, which was quite original, called SPICE, which is an approach where you appeal to the social development, physical development, intellectual development, creative development, and emotional development. And it seemed to work. I even got them on the stage at school doing a play which they had devised. Used to do, I don't know if you know what devised drama is.
I don't. Maybe you could explain more about it. I'm sure there are lots of people out there who would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's a special kind of educational drama which does not use scripts.
Oh, okay. So like improvisation then?
It's like improvisation, which you then block. Block means you get the people on a stage area and you work out with them who's going to enter when, who's going to speak when, what their relationship is in terms of the space. Right. And this really was very successful with them because drama is something which is natural for students. After all, how do we learn when we're little, when we're young? We learn through role play. We learn through interacting with each other. And usually we are taking on roles. And so it's natural for them. I wasn't asking them to learn any new discipline at all, really. But as Sir Ken said, in his very famous TED talk, Do Schools Kill Creativity, that schools do actually knock the natural creativity out of students' bodies, minds, hearts, and souls, and leave them dry. So I was just bringing back playhood, youthful childhood play.
Right. No, that's really interesting. I wondered if you really believe that, Susan, if you think that I know that the institution and if schools and teachers aren't sensitive to the needs of their students, then it can be damaging. But I know that also Sir Ken Robinson's idea about school being in general a place where creativity is being killed was quite controversial, and there were a lot of people who argued against it.
Yes.
You really believe that school is something that doesn't foster creativity?
I do believe it, in the sense that I have observed, I don't know how many classes over the world during my 50-year-long career, and I have seen students still sitting, even in the 21st century, still sitting in rows at brown desks, looking at the backs of other people's heads, and the teacher has obviously convinced them. I'm talking mainly about teenagers because that's my passionate area. I like kindergarten, I like primary, I like adults, but I really love teenagers the best. That's where I've spent most of my time. And I think the teachers have said to them since kindergarten, sit down, sit still, and listen to me. In the main, I'm not saying every school, and I'm certainly not saying every teacher, but right. I would say that the majority of schools in the world still stick to that tradition.
Right. So at the very least, teachers should definitely be aware of that as a kind of dynamic, and try to find ways of being, making sure that creativity enters the classroom, for example. That is
every lesson. Yeah. Every lesson without fail, along with the acronym SPICE, where you've got the other developmental areas being catered for in every lesson. And there are ways to do it, which are not that hard to learn, I think.
Right, right, yeah. And I definitely want to get on to that very shortly, so I'd love to hear about some of your tips. But before we move on to that, what I'd like to ask you about is why drama? Why was it a passion for the theatre? Why did you study drama, and how, you know, was it something you, did you want to act, or was it something that you always knew you wanted to be a teacher and you wanted to combine drama with teaching?
It's a very interesting question. I've written a monologue about it, actually, and performed it on stage, yes. My mother was Irish and my father was Welsh. And my father sang very well, and my mother was a natural party goer, party organizer. She was a seamstress and a cook, an excellent cook. And she was always reading me stories and poems, and we used to act them out at home. But it was something natural. It wasn't something she told me I had to do. We just did it naturally together. And then when I started primary school at the age of five, as we did in those days, we didn't have kindergarten, my teachers recognized that, you know, I had something about me which was very creative, let's say. Yeah. And they soon started asking me to go, when I was about eight, they started asking me to go down to the five-year-old classrooms, the six-year-old classrooms, and tell them my original stories. And I used to just make them up on the spot. And I could have classes of young children spellbound by this eight-year-old who was able to tell these stories. It wasn't anything special for me. It was something I just did. And I didn't know why everybody was kind of amazed about it. And also from the age of five, I was always in the school concert. I was always given poems to read out loud. I was also a good singer. So I was always invited to sing solos at concerts or in the school assemblies in the morning. We used to have religious assemblies in those days. And I was often asked to sing the hymns out loud in front of everybody. And I never had stage fright. You know, I never learned stage fright because I was always doing it. And so I realized But not that I wanted to be an actress. It wasn't that I wanted to be an actress. It was just that it was my passion. I loved doing it. And then I said to my mum, I've decided I want to be a dancer when I grow up. And wow. She said, you won't be doing that. Over my dead body, you'll be doing that. And I thought, and I went back to my ideas, and I said, Mum, I've decided what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be a singer. You won't be a singer. I won't be having you going around the country singing on stage. And I said, okay. And I thought. And then I said, Mum, I've decided what I want to be. I want to be a nurse. No, you won't be being a nurse but around all those people who are dying and sick. I wouldn't be allowing that over my dead body.
Oh, dear.
And so I was at a bit of a loss at that point. My father, who was Welsh, as I told you, said to me, why don't you come into the garden? And why don't we sit in the shed? And we discuss this problem together. So I went out with my father and he said to me, one of the things you really like doing is going up and down the road, helping children with their homework. You're really the teacher in the street. Why don't you think of going to university and doing a degree in philosophy or history? And I said, oh, okay, I'll think about that. And I realised that being a teacher was something that I really wanted to do. I really liked that. And so I did.
Wow, that's an amazing story, Susan. Thanks for sharing it. And how did you end up in Argentina? Because as you said, you've been in Argentina for 30 years. What drew you towards moving away from the UK? Did you work in the UK first, for example?
Yes. My husband's also a teacher. Mm-hmm. And we worked in the UK, in Coventry, actually.
Oh, my husband, you said earlier, didn't you?
Yeah. We went from Warwick University with our degrees to teaching in Coventry. And my husband worked in a rural school and I worked in an urban school right in the middle of Coventry. And we were there for 3.5 years when we decided we really wanted to get promotion. Mm-hmm. And in those days, before your time, the only way to get promotion was to set up clubs in the school and to be recognised for doing that, so that you were already on the ladder, if you like. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm doing motions with my hands here, showing the rungs of the ladder. And we both set up clubs. I did a drama club, obviously, and a reading comics club, because right. All the teachers said, you know, the children couldn't read comics, and I disagreed with that totally. My husband did a cycling club and a music club. Mm. And so we started to get the educational supplement from the Times every Friday. And we were looking for jobs all over the country, all over the United Kingdom, in fact.
Right.
And we found that both of us were turning to the back pages. Now, the back pages were where schools overseas were advertising.
Yeah.
And we thought, hey, instead of moving within the United Kingdom, instead of moving city, as it were, or mm-hmm. country within the United Kingdom, why don't we go somewhere further afield? And so we started applying to jobs overseas, and we were offered one job in Tanzania. It's an international school,
yeah.
And a job in Singapore at the Ministry of Education. So, of course, there were no computers in those days. Mm-hmm. All this was done by typing on a regular typewriter with carbon paper, mm-hmm. and sending your CV and your covering letter in an envelope with a stamp on it from the post office, not knowing when or if you were going to get a reply. So we were very excited about this, but we didn't really know a lot about Tanzania and Singapore, to tell you the truth. We mm-hmm. had been to the library and we'd looked at all the places. And then when we were offered the jobs, we thought, oh, we better go and find out a bit more. So we did that. We went to the local library. But of course, in the local library, you're reading books that have been published years before and have taken time to publish. So they were all out of date. But anyway, we decided, rightly or wrongly, we shall never know, that Singapore was the place we were going to go to. Yeah. So we went to Singapore for 3 years with the Ministry of Education. And after that, we came home with a newly born first child,
right,
who had not been expected. He was 3 months when we got back to England. We were offered another contract, actually.
Okay. But you decided
yeah,
because of the child that
yeah,
you wanted to come back.
Yeah. So we went back to the UK and we were there for 11 days. Bear in mind that we left Singapore in November with temperatures around 30 and sunshine and blue skies every day. And we arrived in a snow-ridden England, freezing cold, to a flat that we had rented out, which did not have a washing machine or a television. And neither of us had a job. So we tried to get jobs in England and we said, okay, the first person to get a job, we'll take it. And the other one will be house person.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough, nothing against the baby, but I was lucky enough to get a job first. So my husband stayed at home as house husband and I went off in the car with my briefcase every day to teach in a comprehensive school, which wow, I loved. I loved it, actually. I had a very special post, which was special teacher for developing all the festivals from all the nationalities that were based in our school.
Oh, wow.
So I had to learn about Diwali, and I had to learn about Ramadan, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very exciting. But we decided we couldn't stay in England. We had changed so much and England hadn't, that we were different people by then.
So is that experience of being in Singapore that led you to thinking we need to go off again? Is that right?
Yes, yes, definitely. We'd been teaching Chinese, Malays and Indians in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And each of those was a different culture. And the thought of being stuck in England just didn't appeal anymore. Mm-hmm. So we, again, started looking at the back pages and we found a job in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So we went off to Saudi Arabia, where I had to wear the black abaya,
okay,
and cover my head with the hijab. And I could not drive. I was not allowed to drive. I was not allowed to go out of the house without my husband accompanying wow, me. And even to the shops, I had to go with him every time. So it was quite an experience. I was head of English in a Muslim school. Mm-hmm. There were only Muslims who were not citizens of Saudi who were allowed in the school. So it was a very interesting international school, in fact. And I really enjoyed the experience. It had its drawbacks, of course, because I was severely restricted. But I learned a lot, and mm-hmm, we learned a lot. We learned how to enjoy ourselves with no facilities, in other words.
Right.
So that was very interesting. We did that for 2 years. And of course, James was with us. That was our baby.
Yeah.
He was with us for the 2 years. And we realized it wasn't a place for a little boy to grow up because we didn't even have a balcony. And we had to go out at 5 o'clock at the weekends for him to play in the park and come back about 10 when it was getting too hot to be outside. So we thought it wasn't a place for him. So we came back again.
Yeah.
And decided the same thing, that we had to go somewhere else. And my mother-in-law, who was a great fan of Spain, found us jobs in Marbella.
Right.
So we went off to Marbella, and that was where we met the Argentines. And they became our friends, our best friends, because they knew how to socialize. They knew how to make barbecues in the woods. They had, some of them had horses.
Wow. And
we used to go horse riding in the woods with our children. And every weekend we were out there in the woods with the Argentines. So one day they said to us, "Have you ever thought of going to Argentina?" And we said, "Not really." And they said, "Argentina would love you and you would love Argentina." So we said, "Okay."
Wow. And that, so you ended up working in international schools in Argentina then, in Buenos Aires?
Bilingual schools, yes.
Bilingual schools. Yeah.
Those are very, very special schools. It's an incredible system, really. Most of them have the Spanish curriculum in the morning,
yeah,
and the British curriculum, or in a few, the American curriculum in the afternoon. Some of them do it the other way around, but most of them do it like that. And the students go from 8 o'clock in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. And they do this dual curriculum, and they come out absolutely fluent in both languages, in all of the skills.
Wow.
It's quite an incredible system.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. And so that was it then. Once you were in Argentina, you were kind of very happy to be there. Or were you tempted? Have you been tempted in these last 30 years to go anywhere else?
Definitely, yes. The problem was we had Sarah in Spain. So she came with James to Argentina with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the idea was, we had a 2-year contract at a bilingual school. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, after that contract, to go to Africa. We had never taught in Africa, and that was something that we had plans to do. But the school offered us another contract,
mm-hmm.
a 4-year contract. And in fact, my husband was head of middle school and I was head of secondary. Mm-hmm. And they offered the contract to my husband. It was a boys' school.
Yeah.
And they offered the contract to my husband, but asked me if I would stay on as secondary head. So I said, not very sure about that, but I'll sign on for 2 years. And my husband signed on for 4 years. And we had really enjoyed working in the school. And our children were in the same school, so we knew what they were up to, et cetera, et cetera. And we were doing all the international exams, of course, up to ACE level. The mm-hmm. A levels in IGCSE, you know?
Yeah.
And we really enjoyed it, but things went haywire, as we say here. And there was some argument between my husband and the owner, and we decided to leave the school, and we didn't know if we were going back to England or what we were going to do. But we decided we were going to stay on nevertheless. My husband got a job in another bilingual school very, very quickly. And I got a job as the director of a teacher's center, which did many, many sessions, 30 sessions, mm-hmm. Appealing to the Spanish side and the English side of these bilingual schools. And that was one of my favorite jobs that I'd ever had. But then, of course, we decided to move on in a different way. My husband stayed at his school. I got a job in his school as head of secondary again, because really I wanted to be back with the children. I wanted to be back with the yeah. teenagers. I was missing them. And then I became a conference speaker. I was invited all around the country first.
Yeah.
Then it became Latin America, then it became the world. And so I became a freelance consultant. So it's quite a long story. I'm sorry.
No, it's really interesting. It's one of the things that appeals to me about doing this show, Susan, is that I know lots of people like yourself, and we've had opportunities to meet, etc. But you never have an opportunity to talk in length or in depth
about
somebody's background experience. So this gives me that opportunity. And I would love now actually to turn to how you use drama with your teenage students, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people say, oh, you can't do drama with teenagers. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's where I started. I was trained as a primary secondary teacher of dramatic arts. And that's where I started. I started with these remedial 13, 14-year-olds in a comprehensive school. And I saw that the drama really worked. Now, the drama that I do is not theatre.
Right.
And I want to stress this because a lot of people don't really get the difference. And I have also been criticised by many people for trying to make a distinction between the two things.
So what is the distinction then?
Okay. Susan? The distinction is basically this, if I can put it into a nutshell. In theatre, you use scripts.
Yeah.
Which are written by people who are very old or dead, come from a completely different culture from yours, and it's their words that you're using, not right. your words. So if I'm going to do drama in the second language of my students, I need to have them getting some language, which I do very, very cleverly, if you like, and then using it in improvisation, role play, language games, and I appeal to their ability to play. So what right. we are doing in drama is playing with the body, the voice, the soul, the heart, the mind, and also playing with language.
Mm-hmm.
So it all becomes very motivating and fun for all of them. Even if you begin with some who are a little bit reluctant to give it a go, they always edge in. They always come in the end because they see that it's the nearest thing to real life that they've ever done in an English language classroom.
Right.
So we don't do grammar and we don't do theatre either. We don't need costumes, makeup, sound, equipment, a stage. We don't need anything. We just need a teacher with a good understanding of what educational drama is, how to do it, how to set up the strategies. And there are hundreds of strategies.
So, Susan, could you take us through perhaps just one example of how you would approach doing an activity with your teenage students that involves
Sure. You're going to have to visualize this if you can.
Sure, sure.
Okay? So the first thing is to close your eyes, think about a classroom that you have been in or that you're going to be in, and visualize the layout in the classroom. So the first thing we have to do, and this sounds very superficial, but it isn't, mm-hmm. we have to move the desks.
Yeah.
We have to get the desks out the way. If you've got a class of 45 students and you've got all the desks in rows, the only way I have found to do it is to push all the desks to the side so that they are all backwards against the wall.
Yeah.
And then to put the chairs underneath them and for the students to sit on the desks.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a square. Really, yeah. I want a circle. I call it the magic circle.
Right.
And if we've got a classroom that's big enough for that, that's our starting point. We put the chairs and exactly the same number of chairs as we have students. So we don't have any gaps If we have gaps, the magic is able to creep out. So we want the chairs all next to each other in a joined circle, and the teacher is in the circle with the students.
Yeah.
So I become at the same level, if you like, as the students. And right. then we start off with everybody standing up and doing breathing exercises. So we are stealing from theatre, but we're mm-hmm. just stealing the things that make the lesson healthy. So we are looking after the well-being of our students, first of all. Many students come to English language classes in a state of anxiety.
Hmm.
And we don't realize it because we're not sensitive enough to it. So we have to learn that we have to get the students to relax, to breathe, to feel more confident, to feel that they can actually do this class with us.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is absolutely vital. If you don't do that and you don't train them, and I use the word purposefully, if you don't train them to use their voices properly and to feel confident enough, you will never get anywhere with them. You will have resistance. So first of all, you've got to make sure that your students know two things. One, you need them to be there with you, and you need them to be there in that moment and to stay in that moment with you for the whole lesson. Because as soon as they are disengaged, they stop learning.
So how do you guarantee that then, or how do you foment that to actually get them? I mean, obviously physically it's very easy, you can get them in the room with you, but how do you engage their attention right at the beginning?
Right. So you do it by the breathing exercises first.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you go from the breathing exercises into some kind of warm-up, energizer. And there are thousands of them out there. There's a free booklet online called The Improvisation Encyclopedia.
Right.
And that's got about 200 exercises in it. So you need to learn how to do it. And this is where classroom management comes into play.
Right.
Because if you don't know how to deal with your students when they're out of their desks, that is a problem. And
right.
this is why I believe lots of teachers won't do it, because they feel they're losing control.
Mm-hmm.
My answer to that is always the same. You gain control, because drama is the art of self-control.
Mm-hmm.
It is the art of thinking. It is the art of being spontaneous in the moment with your new fluency in the language. So, for example, after we've done the breathing, we may go on to something like limb count, where I have them all, they're already standing. So mm-hmm. they're already relaxed. They've already used their voice doing some breathing exercise, which are voice warm-ups as well. And then I say to them, okay, I want you to count to eight, and I want you to waft your right hand eight times. And as you waft, and then I check with them, they know what waft means.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them it's like when ladies or gentlemen put their nail varnish on and they shake their hands in the air to dry it. That's wafting, okay? So we do everything through metaphor and through visualizations when we can. And so we waft eight times and we say the numbers loudly, breathing as you have been taught to breathe. So we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And we are moving, we are wafting, we are speaking, we are enjoying it, generally speaking. And then I say left, and we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 with the left hand. And then I go foot. And so we do same with our feet, but we balance on one leg and we waft the right foot. And then I say left, and they waft the left leg. And then I go, I bend over forward and I bring my right hand down to my open palm on my left hand and I go, half. What's half of eight? Four. Okay, now we waft. Four, 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 four. Right arm, left arm, right leg, left leg. And then I go, half. And we do it for two. And then I go, half. And we do it for one. And then when we've done one, 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 we jump up in the air with our hands up and we say, woohoo!
Wow. Susan, do you have any, what about students who are kind of maybe a bit shy or reluctant? Or yeah. Is it the actual doing these initial exercises that kind of breaks the ice and gets them involved?
I think it's got a lot to do with expectations. I go into the classroom expecting all students to join in.
Yeah.
And they do. I really find it difficult to explain it, but I think it's to do with my high expectations and my ability to do very, very good classroom management. Obviously, I've had students who've defied me, or I've had students who say, oh, I can't do it. And I say, of course you can. We can all do it. Let's just try. And if you've tried and you can't do it, then okay. We'll leave you as you are. But one thing I will not allow, and this is something that students have criticized me a lot for, is I will not let them sit and watch.
Okay. So you that want is them not, to be all actively involved in some way.
Yes. I will not let them sit out and watch the other people, because that's exactly why they're saying they don't want to do it. They don't want to do it because they feel embarrassed about doing it in front of other people. And it's not a thing that teenagers usually do, wafting. Mm-hmm. but it's always worked in my classes. That's just one example. And then we go on to the core of the lesson. Mm-hmm. So we may be, we think of a theme, or I think of a theme. So it could be bullying, or it could be journey, your journey, or it could be change.
How do you choose? Is it, do you let the students choose, or do you choose for them based on what you think they need or want?
In the first instance, I choose. But once I've got them hooked, and they always get hooked, I let them start choosing. And this really comes from Dorothy Heathcott, mm-hmm. who was my guru, if you like, at university. I read all her stuff and admired mm-hmm. her approach enormously. She was she worked in a woolen mill with her mother from when she was 14. She left school at 14. She failed her 11 plus. But she had this approach and she wanted to be an actress in the first place. And the factory owner said that he could see this in her. And so he sent her to the local Yorkshire Amateur Society. But the leader of the Amateur Society said to her, Dorothy, I hate to tell you this, but you are never going to be an actress. You're just not the right shape.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yes. And Dorothy had to agree because she realized, but she knew she wanted to teach this approach to teachers. And she soon got a job at Newcastle University as a professor. And she then went on to be an international consultant. She went all over the world with this method. And so I have taken her method, but made it more to do with English language. And one of her methods was asking the students, what play shall we do today? No scripts, no scripts. And they would say, oh, let's do pirates. And she'd say, okay, right then. Okay, get your things ready. Let's get on board. And then she'd start the drama like that and she would be part of it. And if it was failing at any point, she would find a way to bring it back together again. She was absolutely brilliant.
So she was your teacher at university, was she?
Or? No, no, I never even met her, I'm sorry to say.
How did you come across her teachings or her methods?
She was introduced to me at university, along with Vygotsky, who also taught very rigorously about play, childhood play, and along with Ivan Illich, who talked about schools changing their methodology, and Neil Postman, who you may know, deschooling, and Maria Montessori, who was into active learning, learning by doing, and John Dewey, of course. John Dewey was the first one, really. And I just went on to learn about anything I could about Dorothy Heathcote, because I was completely bowled over by her method. And so in the drama lesson, we do everything in an active way. It is an experiential subject. But as we're dealing with second language learners, we have to deal with a lot of fluency building, a lot of thinking skills building. So the language becomes more automatic. So we put them into very mini role plays and we have them working with the language that they have got, not somebody else's stilted language, which isn't going to be any use to them in their everyday dealings with other second language learners. So this is how we do it. So we go on to a theme and let's take bullying, for example. We ask them what they know about bullying. Have they been bullied? And we may need to feed in the vocabulary depending on the level we're dealing with. If we need to feed in the vocabulary, we as teachers know that. And so we have the vocabulary already ready in the shape of something artistic, a song, a poem, a story. I'm very, very keen on using stories because that naturally appeals to students' understanding, especially if it's in the form of a picture book. And one of the things I did very, very successfully in secondary school was to train the students to tell picture book stories to kindergarten. And that was a very, very successful project because they ended up dressing up as the characters in the story. And we had a reader, we had a pointer, and we had the characters dressed up. And it was so successful. And it was their idea to dress up. It wasn't my idea. They just got so hooked on it. Because the story appeals to everybody. And we can help, some teachers don't agree with me on this, we can help our second language students understand better if we've got the visuals. Yeah. And I do also believe in multisensory education. So if you can make your English language teaching auditory, kinesthetic, which is through movement, and this is where songs and rhymes with movement attached to them come into play, or taste, smell, and what have I missed out? No, I've got them all in.
I think so.
So we do, we study bullying through dialogue, through talk, through inserting any language structures we need to as we go along, but we don't do the grammar.
Right. So you don't explicitly teach language structure, grammar, etc. You just deal with the language that the students need based on the activity, the role play, the drama activities you're doing.
Yes. Right? Scott Thornbury called it emergent language.
Exactly.
And I had never called it that, but that's what I've been doing all my 50 years in teaching. I've been dealing with emergent language.
And so one thing I'd love to ask you then is, you were obviously given the freedom to do that by the school that you worked with. Some teachers, I'm sure, out there will listening in now will be thinking, well, I'd love to do that, but I am not given that kind of freedom. Do you think that was something that – was it something that you had to fight for? Was it you were just lucky at being left to do what you thought right? What was it?
I think it's a combination, really. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had to fight for it so much as convince the head of department that what I was doing was right for my students and right for me as well.
Yeah.
I was brought into the headmaster's office in my first school because I didn't only have the remedials. I had the remedials for 18 periods a week. And then I had other classes. I had some A-level classes as well. And I was brought into the headmaster's office and I was told that I had to teach like Miss, whoever it was, I won't say her name, because she always got good results in the international exams. And I said, I am going to get good results as well with my methodology. And he said, okay, I'll give you 6 months to show me your results. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. So he was good enough to let me go for it. I don't know why, really. But what I say to teachers is, if you've got a textbook and you are confined to your textbook, which is the death of imagination for me, because all creativity comes out of imagination. Mm-hmm. And this is what every child, every teenager, every adult brings to the classroom every day. And we flaunt it. We don't take it into account. And so I say to the teachers, if you can't be totally creative, don't worry. Keep the text, change the task.
Right.
So you keep the text and you keep to your syllabus and your curriculum, but you change what the students have to do with it. So instead of doing true false exercises by drawing lines or by putting F for false and T for true, I get all the students standing up and I take the text and I call out phrases from the text and they have to raise their right hand if it's true and raise their left hand if it's false. You can play that game with grammar if you want. You can play it with everything, in fact. That's just one game that I do.
Yeah. So you get the students being more active than they would if you were just following the what you were supposed to do according to the actual textbook.
Exactly. And some parents find it very tricky because they say to their children, what did you do at school today? And they say, they raise their shoulders, you know, they shrug their shoulders and they say nothing. And then the parents come into school and they say, what are you doing with my child? And I say, the thing is that what I'm doing with them is teaching them true communication. Yeah. And from this methodology, this approach, they will be able to read better, write better, listen better, because all my instructions are verbal instructions.
Yeah.
And they always look at each other, and here in Argentina, they say, ¿Qué dijo? What did she say? You know, and I say, don't say that to somebody else. Say it to me. Put your hand up and say, I don't understand what I've got to do. Can you explain again? I will always explain again. I will always model it for you. I will always demonstrate it with a couple of students who understand what I'm going on about. It's as simple as that in the end.
But you need the feedback before you can do that, really. And they need to talk to you about it, not try to hide it.
Exactly.
Understand. Yeah.
And why do they try to hide it? That's a very, very good question. Mm-hmm. They try to hide it because teachers in the past have always insisted that they follow instructions and do it the first time. Well, they can't. They can't always do it the first time. So we have to be more sensitive and more understanding and more patient, let's say.
Right, right. So
have I given you any clue about what drama is?
Oh, definitely. It's all coming through. It's very clear, I think. Susan, I'd love to ask you about how you approach the activities that you've, the methodology and activities that you've just talked about with specific needs students. And if there are any kind of pointers you could give teachers to particular specific needs and how you would adapt your approach to teaching them.
I was the coordinator of 20 teachers in the city of Buenos Aires in the Ministry of the Ministry of Education in the special needs department. Yeah. And I was training them to teach English for the first time in Argentina, in fact, in the special schools where they were working. And we based everything we did on a project which is called Story Sacks. Mm-hmm. This is a project I learned many years ago. The idea is that you get some kind of bag or pillowcase or sack, whatever it is, a container. Mm-hmm. And in that container, you have a storybook which preferably has pictures, which preferably has a lot of movement within the story itself. So you have to select a little bit more carefully. And then you add into your story sack a whole stack of strategies, cards, flashcards. Always have a ball, because you're always going to be using a ball in drama to pass it around, to hook people on answering, rather than saying, okay, Juana, can you answer this question for me? You don't do that in drama, you just pass the ball. So it becomes very dynamic. And then maybe you have jigsaw puzzles, maybe you have memory games, maybe you have a whole stack of cones, you know, those cones they use are on the road for the students to run through, to use the flashcards which are on the floor, for example, or on various places in the classroom. Yeah. And anything else that you can think of. For example, I had a story called Penguin's Tales. And it was about a penguin who was a liar. Penguin who told tales. And one of the things I had in my story sack was a set of binoculars. Right. And I did the story with the students, and then I would hand the binoculars round, and they would tell us what the penguin was doing, and they would tell us what the penguin was saying. So we do quite a lot of repetition to make the language stick. We call it stickability. Yeah. And we make sure that we've always got realia. So we've always got something for them to hold, or, for example, something for them to smell. So you have a perfume bottle and you say, OK, story time. And they know that they've got to come and sit on the rug, or they know they've got to sit in a circle or whatever. And they know they're going to be exploring the story through movement, through smell, maybe through taste if it fits in, through visuals, and through sound.
Right.
And this is what we include in every lesson, along with the spice. So we have them working in pairs, we have them working in groups, but mainly in special needs, as our classes were quite small, ranging from, say, 7 children to 18, they were quite small, we mainly kept them in the circle. Because then we could and kind of contain them, let's say, not control them, but contain them a little bit better. And of course, all these activities are very, very good for your dyslexic students, for yeah. your autistic students, for your Asperger's students. The ones which were in one way a little bit more difficult, but in fact, we had a lot of success with them, are the students who've got cerebral palsy mm-hmm. and who are tethered to wheelchairs mm-hmm. because they can't mm-hmm. actually control their bodies very well. But they loved the lessons. They were so happy when they saw their teachers arriving with the story sack over their shoulders. And then, in fact, every teacher shared their story sack with another teacher. So it was great professional development because they had to teach each other what the activities were inside the story sack. So right. my advice to anybody who's got specific needs students in their classroom is that they shouldn't single them out. They should make their classroom as inclusive and as multisensory as possible. And that way they will reach them. Because I always say, you've got to reach before you can teach.
Mm.
If you don't reach them, you can't teach them.
Of course, you need to reach them. You need for them to be engaged before you can get anything, get them to understand or take in anything, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we always do a lot of concept checking, a lot of understanding. Okay, tell me, somebody, what you're going to do now. Yeah. So we get them to repeat the instructions. And I think what a lot of teachers don't understand is that in drama, they are hearing more language than in any other subject, because most other subjects are reading and writing.
Right.
Or listening, if you do listening exercises. But those listening exercises are usually quite stilted and you cannot evaluate it in the way that you can evaluate their understanding in a drama class, because you can see if they're doing it or not.
Right.
You can yeah. see if they're understanding what they've got to do.
You're getting instant feedback, aren't you?
Yes, yes. And they become extremely confident. I think this is one of the things that I love about drama so much, that through the spice and the multisensory and giving the instructions and checking on the instructions, they become very quick thinkers. Mm-hmm. And I do a game with them, for example, which goes around the circle, where I say black, white. And the student sitting next to me on the right-hand side, it doesn't matter, it can go the other way as well, on the right-hand side says white. So she repeats, or he repeats, my last word and says something that it reminds him of. So he says, white reminds me of snow. And the next one says, snow reminds me of cold. And the next one says, cold reminds me of hot. Because this structure, reminds me of, is very difficult for Spanish speakers. We don't have such a structure in Spanish.
Right, of course, yeah.
And then we repeat it because we go all around the circle again. And this is a perfect example of multisensory teaching, because they are placing their memory in the look of the teenager who said it, in the sound of the teenager who said it, and in the position in which they are sitting in the circle. I'm pointing all around the circle with my finger now, imagining that you can see me doing it. And so we do this exercise.
That's the interesting thing about this radio show format, is that you're probably doing lots of body language, etc. But
yes.
We don't appreciate it, but it's all coming through. I'm not losing anything, so that's good.
Okay. And then another game we do, for example, is I take a scarf in And I wrapped the scarf up into a kind of bundle and I put it in my arms and I shake my arms as though I'm cradling a baby. And I say to my scarf, "Hello, Gucci, 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 Gucci. Aren't you beautiful?" And then I hold the scarf up and I say to the group, "This is not a scarf, it's a..." And then I do the mime again and somebody is bound to say, "Baby."
Of course, yeah. And you think then, it would be the obvious thing that people would say, but I'm sure I'm sure there are a few people who say some odd things.
Not with that one particularly, but other more obscure ones, yes, they say some different things. Yeah. So then I pass the scarf on to the next person and they have to cradle the baby and they have to say, "Gucci, Gucci, Gucci, Gucci. This is not a baby, it's a..." And then they have to do something different with the scarf. So some of them roll it into a ball and put it on their head.
Right.
And the others would say, "It's a hat."
Okay.
And then they pass it on to the next student. The next student does the mime and say, "This is not a hat, it's a..." And then maybe they make it into a sling for a broken arm.
Hmm. And so it continues. That's really good. You're kind of activating their imagination. It's a fun activity. And they're having to listen to understand. So it's all very good. Yeah, it's a great activity.
It works really, really well because, strangely, they're not thinking in English here.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking in Spanish, probably, I imagine, because they're visualizing the mime in their own language. We don't really know the answer to this, but I think it's like this. And then the rest of them have to think of the English vocabulary. And obviously, if they're stuck, like I usually do the noose, I wrap the scarf around my head and hold it up and die, you know, with the scarf held up in the air like a noose.
Right.
And they don't know that word. They say rope. And I say, "Well, yes, it is a rope, but there's a special word for it in English." So then I teach them some new vocabulary.
Right, of course, yeah. There's lots of opportunities for doing lots of vocabulary work there.
Absolutely.
So, Susan, this is really interesting. What other aspects of creativity do you think that teachers can add to their classroom apart from drama? Because you've done a lot of talking about activating imaginations and a lot of physical activities using the drama activities, etc. But there are any ways that we haven't talked about related to creativity that you also use?
Yes, I think that creativity in general is still the use of the imagination,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't necessarily have to be drama. Mm-hmm. So you could introduce into your classroom, for example, when you're telling a story, ask the students to draw a picture of each scene. So storyboarding, for example, I don't know if you know that activity, but storyboarding is actually a creative activity. It's putting yourself in the role of the artistic director of a film. And you are dividing the story into separate sections, which would be the scenes of the film, if you like.
Yeah.
And you are drawing what you are going to see through the camera. And you are actually blocking, as I said before, the people on the stage of your film. So I often ask students to see something as a film and draw it. And then afterwards, if we have time, I would turn it into a drama as well.
Right.
So they actually move it. They actually move the pictures. There are lots and lots of things you can do. One that I love doing with students is visualizations. So I ask them to sit and this can be done in rows. I mean, you don't have to have the magic circle for this. They can sit on their chair in a comfortable position and you do a little bit of breathing with them. And then you get them to listen to the sounds in the room. And then you get them to move out of the room in their imagination and see what's outside the room. Listen to the sounds outside the room. And you keep going and going and going and going until you're actually flying off the earth into the universe. What can they see there? And then you bring them back to the room and you ask them to either go and put their ear to the wall of the classroom and listen to the story of the wall. The walls have ears. So this is using a proverb, the walls have ears, but putting it into action, putting it into greater understanding. Because all the walls have ears, right? They've all heard the story of what's going on in that room at that time. So they come back to the classroom and I usually let them go into the corridors, out into the gardens or whatever, listen to the trees, do a bit of tree hugging at the same time. And they come back and they tell their stories. And it's been very, very successful.
I'm sure it sounds like a really interesting activity. What kind of responses do you get from students? Are they very literal about, do students think, start talking about what they think happened in that classroom in a previous event, or are they more sort of surreal? Or
that's a great question, because you get everything. You get some students who come back and say, my wall didn't tell me anything. They couldn't remember anything. And I say, well, that's a great cop-out, that is. So you're not going to entertain us. Okay, anybody else? And then somebody will come up with an absolutely amazing story that you couldn't have thought of yourself. And then somebody else will come up with a real, really realistic story of what happened in the classroom between the teacher and a student, for example. But they come up with all sorts of things. And in my last school where I was teaching, I was headmistress as well. So that's another reason why I've always been able to do these things, because I've been a headmistress since 1980.
Right.
Since I was in Saudi. Always a teaching headmistress, by the way, because I never believed you should just tell people what to do without showing them that you also had problems doing it.
Of course. That's the best way of inspiring other teachers, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And so I used to let the students, when they were going off to listen to the walls, I used to let them go into my office as well. And then that inspired them more, I think, because they came out of the office with great stories of how bad I'd been to students, etc., etc.
Wow. Amazing. So, Susan, we're coming towards the end of our time together. I've really enjoyed listening to you and hearing about more about your methodology, and in particular, I'm very grateful for you sharing specific details of activities, etc. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to say that we haven't managed to talk about? Anything that you're particularly interested in teaching, learning, education-wise, that you'd like to talk about?
Basically, I've always thought that teaching and learning had to be interactive. Mm-hmm. There had to be dialogue, and there had to be an understanding on everybody's part that teaching wasn't a one-way thing and learning wasn't an individual thing. As Vygotsky said, we need to interact with the teacher. The teacher needs to interact with the students, and the students have to interact with each other. That's how we learn. We learn in communities which the teacher sets up to be positive communities. And so the students believe that they are making progress. I think it's when the students feel they're not making progress because they don't get it, or they've reached a plateau, you know, at the intermediate stage where they tend to reach a plateau and they don't seem to be able to climb any further up the mountain. I want them to get to the summit. I want them to always be climbing higher. And I think that this is something that we have to learn to do through strategies. I believe that the only way to teach is not by telling. It's to use strategies which create or facilitate learning situations. I was taught this at university in 1969, that teachers are not instructors. Teachers are facilitators of learning situations. So I have to devise my situations through creativity, through what we call the frames of drama. There are lots and lots of books out there telling you how to do process drama, how to apply drama, how to apply creativity, how to think like Leonardo da Vinci, for example, mm-hmm. which is something I've studied very, very broadly. And if teachers can see beyond the instruction and see beyond the rote learning, then we're going to move it. Then we're going to transform education. And that's what Sir Ken said. It's not just changing education. It's doing a revolution. And I'm a founding member of the Creative Revolution, which is set up to honor Sir Ken's work. And it's a very, very interesting group. I'm also a member of the Global Play Brigade, which is a group of activists. They come from theatre, mm-hmm. from sculpting, from acting, from painting, drawing. They are speech therapists, that they are teachers. And they believe in building across borders through play. And that's right. What I recently got interested in. And I think it's a real movement for positivity in the world. And I think all teachers go into teaching because they want to change the world. I don't know if you would agree with me.
I think so. I think if you're not someone who wants to change the world, or at least a little bit, then perhaps you shouldn't be in teaching.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Susan, thank you so much for joining me today and for spending some of your Saturday talking to me. And I know you spent a lot of time prior to our conversation trying to get the technology to work. So I'm sorry you had difficulties, and thanks for persisting, because it's been fascinating talking.
No, thank you for your patience, and thank you for helping me, and thank you for the great questions that you asked.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you, Susan, and catching up. It's great. And enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you. I'm going for lunch now.
Oh, have fun. Enjoy yourself.
Thank you. And you enjoy yourself for the rest of the weekend as well. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye. Bye for now.
So that brings us to the end of today's Twilight Show. Many thanks to today's special guest, Susan Hilliard, and all of you who joined us live. And so that's it from me. There are Teachers Talk radio shows all week on all manner of interesting topics. So please, please listen in live or to some of the recordings. And I hope you will join me again, not next week, but the week after at the same time. Bye for now.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.